I grew up during the Cold War. I still remember as a young man having my teacher teach all of us in school to duck and cover if the bomb came. Somehow we would be safer if we were underneath our desks, as if that would make much difference. But what I also remember growing up in the Cold War was that there was one approach that we had when we were dealing with the Soviets, and that was the concept of containment, and about the idea that somehow we couldn't beat them per se. It was sort of mutual destruction. So what we tried to do was contain them. Well, somebody has taken a closer look. Our next guest has taken a closer look at this concept of containment and is looking at applying it today to what we're facing and what it means. Ian Shapiro, he's a political science professor at Yale University. Professor, thank you for joining me.
I'm delighted to be with you.
This is a very interesting look because, to me, it looks back. It looks back to a man named George Kennan, but then it looks to the future and applies it in a way I don't know if we'd ever even thought of yet, or at least a lot of people have rejected, and now maybe they should.
Yeah, I think that what you said is accurate. People haven't looked closely enough at the ways in which containment can be used to confront the threats we face today. In fact, of course, even since the end of the Cold War, we've used containment quite successfully against rogue states and terrorist enabling regimes, most obviously in Iraq itself. Between 1991 and 2003, we very effectively contained Saddam Hussein's regime. But then, even more dramatically, though perhaps less well known about in the U.S., we used containment with enormous effectiveness against Libya, transforming it from a rogue state that was a sponsor of terrorism, a financer of terrorism against the West, we basically transformed it into a state that presents us with no threat whatsoever and has even now given up its nuclear program.
It's interesting when you bring up Libya, because I know that when that took place, you can go back into the 90s, mm-hmm. where we were working very aggressively against them to isolate them as much mm-hmm. as possible, to make them hurt as much as possible, so they would at least conclude that the path that they were taking was not a benefit to their own country.
Right.
And yet, what we also saw was some seemed to try to take advantage of when Libya actually did turn and say, no, it wasn't because of the containment issue. It was because of our willingness to attack in Iraq and their fear that we would attack there. See, so it just simply justifies our attacking Iraq. You see
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, but the history belies that. As I argue in my book, Containment, Rebuilding a Strategy Against Global Terror, the policy changes in Iran long predate our invasion of Iraq. By the late 1990s, they were turning over the Lockerbie bombers for trial. They were paying compensation to British and French victims of Libyan-sponsored terrorism. And indeed, they were making overtures to the Clinton administration to give up their nuclear weapons program in return for having sanctions lifted. So they've been knocking on the door for years. It's simply not credible to claim that we needed to invade Iraq in order to get Libya to conform. You know, instead of Iraq being the model for Libya, Libya should have been the model for Iraq, as it now should be the model for Iran.
We're talking with Ian Shapiro, his book, Containment, Rebuilding a Strategy Against Global Terror. Professor, when you look at containment as we used it against the Soviet Union, is there a difference between the Soviet Union in terms of having one location, one cohesive group, and something like Al-Qaeda on this war on terror, where it's subgroups scattered across the world? And can you apply containment to that sort of a threat?
You can, but you have to modify it for exactly the reason that's implied in your question. Namely, the Soviet Union was a single adversary that was in one fixed geographical location. When we're dealing with terrorist groups, they can move around. But what we really have to do is focus on the enabling regimes and contain them, because no terrorist group, Al-Qaeda included, can present a serious ongoing threat to the national security of the United States if they don't have a territorial sanctuary somewhere. You know, they had been kicked out of Saudi Arabia, they had been kicked out of Khartoum, they'd been forced from pillar to post before they wound up in Afghanistan in the run-up to their attack on the World Trade Center. And if you think about groups like the PLO, over the years, they've been far less dangerous at times when they have not had territorial sanctuaries. Because terrorist groups, in order to present any kind of real threat, have to have training camps, they have to be equipped, they have to organize themselves, they have to have some sort of territorial base. But as you say, the territorial bases can be in different parts of the world. And we therefore, in order to have effective containment, we have to always be willing to work with regional powers. So what this means, for example, in the Middle East is, as the Baker Commission recognized in its report at Christmas time, the only way we can have an effective containment regime against Iraq now is going to involve working closely with Syria and Iran, because they are in a position to help us control the borders of Iraq, which are porous to terrorists in both directions. So regional alliances, and then in addition to that, using international institutions, international peacekeepers and other organs of the UN to help us police the borders of these states are essential pieces of containment in the war that we face now.
But how realistic is it, if we can turn to that last part of what you just said, about using the UN, using international peacekeepers? I recall the war between Lebanese, or at least Hezbollah, and Israel, and the need to send peacekeepers there. And that was, a relatively speaking, a small number in a very small area, and they had a terrible time getting enough people to do that. Who's going to be actually controlling the border or following the border between Iraq and Iran, Iraq and Kuwait, Iraq and Syria, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that's an excellent question that you ask. And indeed, as I said, it's not just international institutions. You have to work with powers in the region. I'll tell you an interesting anecdote. When I was doing the research for containment, rebuilding a strategy against global terror, I interviewed a retired Israeli general, and it was just after we had forced the Syrians out of Lebanon. And I asked him what he thought of this, and he said, well, we could have gotten the Syrians out of Lebanon any time. As your listeners may or may not know this, but Syria had been in Lebanon since Henry Kissinger invited them in 1976. And the sort of standard one-liner in Washington was, only the Syrians can hold Lebanon together. When we forced the Syrians out of Lebanon, the Israeli general made the point to me. He said, of course, now Hezbollah will expand to fill the vacuum. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. And then we saw the results of that in the conflict with Israel a year later. So when you're dealing with weak states, I think you're right to say international institutions are not enough. But then the functioning states in the neighborhood become essential to policing the borders of weak states from which terrorism can be exported. Syria has plenty of common interests with us in stabilizing the situation in Iraq, as do the Iranians. If you think about it, you know, Iran and the U.S. have many common interests in the Middle East, in, for instance, in not seeing a return to power of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and in not seeing Iraq break up, because if Iraq breaks up, the Iranians will themselves have a huge problem with the Kurds in northern Iran. So there are plenty of common interests, despite all the saber rattling, and we're going to need to work with these powers if we're going to have an effective containment strategy for post-occupation Iraq.
Do we have the desire to work with so many different people? I mean, obviously, we could talk about the Iraq issue, but I can take you all over the world, parts of Southeast Asia. I can take you into the Horn of Africa. Are we prepared to fund and really help the Ethiopians against Somalia? I mean, that's a perfect example of this instability that you're talking about.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know, Colonel Nunez in the National War College has tackled this problem quite imaginatively, I think, and has made the case that what's really needed is NATO-like organizations on every continent, regional alliances whose goal is to preserve stability and to police weak states. They shouldn't all be U.S.-led, obviously, but they need to be American support for and facilitation of the kinds of alliances that can do this, because it's by and large only the powers on the ground and the powers in the neighborhood that have the capacity and the interest to help solve the security problems that arise out of weak states.
We're talking with Ian Shapiro. His book, Containment, Rebuilding a Strategy Against Global Terror. Again, Professor, this seems to fly in the face of the current administration's policy to not just Iraq, but to a lot of the world. Do you foresee this administration changing or the next?
I don't foresee this administration changing very much. They have changed some in the sense that the Bush Doctrine was first enunciated right after 9/11, they declared containment to be obsolete. More recently, partly because they've been forced back into containment strategies in dealing with North Korea and Iran following the massive demonstration of American weakness in Iraq, they've softened their position somewhat, and now they say, well, the traditional policy of containment needs to be supplemented by the Bush Doctrine of preemptive war and unilateral action. But of course, that's like saying the traditional method of putting out fires with water needs to be supplemented by pouring gasoline on them. You know, and I think to answer your question directly, my belief is that the Bush administration is says exactly what it means when the president says the answer in Iraq is going to be decided by the next administration. I think their goal is to kick the can down the road at this point. So they will do what they need to do to prevent a total meltdown in Iraq. They'll put more troops into the Sunni triangle and so on. But I think they're pretty much determined to turn this into the next administration's problem.
But isn't the real problem is inside that can that's being kicked are a whole bunch of American soldiers, men and
Absolutely.
Women.
Absolutely. You know, and at the sort of rates we're talking about, you're probably talking about another 1,500 dead American soldiers between now and the next American national election, not to mention countless thousands of dead Iraqi civilians.
It's a legitimate question to be asking. Certainly, we will continue talking about it. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure. Ian Shapiro, his book, Containment, Rebuilding a Strategy Against Global Terror. It's important to understand the distinctions, not necessarily which side is the right one, but if you don't have the conversation, you don't even know where to go next.